1979, and we're going to begin by her reading the release form so we know that in her point of view it's all right.
I hereby give to the Buffalo Women's Oral History Project the tapes recorded on December 27, 1979, for such educational and scholarly uses and purposes as the Directors E. Kennedy, M. Davis, and A. Michelson shall determine. I further consent to the transcription and the publication of any or all of this interview as educational and scholarly work required. I have been assured that only my first name will be employed in any use of these tapes. I understand that at some future date, the tapes will be housed in an archive chosen by the directors of the Buffalo Women's Oral History Project and will be available for public access, governed by the rules of the archive. I give consent that these tapes be made available for research purposes at any time.
That's all you need.
Okay. I got confused.
Okay, the first thing I wanted to ask you was, if in writing a book about the history of the lesbian community, what do you think are the most important things to be included as you look back? What do you think are the essential things that you just want to be sure got into a book on the history of the lesbian community?
Well, one of the things that I think about very frequently is how the quote-unquote younger generation seems to think that they're so terribly oppressed. And going back to when I came out, that was when was true oppression. I think as I talked to you in the bar that one night about one of the experiences I had in California, and that went back to 1962. I can remember, and I think basically that's it. I think that if the lesbian community was more aware of how, I can't say unoppressed, that they're not as oppressed as people of my age, that they might be more comfortable in coming out and be more comfortable in being themselves, and it might possibly relieve some of the guilt feelings that they have to deal with.
Why do you think there's less oppression now?
Well, I think it's probably because in the last 10 years, you know, things mm-hmm. have moved on so much, particularly since the Stonewall riots. However, I don't associate gay liberation quite so with the Stonewall riots as I do with Metropolitan Community Church. You know, being very involved in that, I mm-hmm. feel that that was one of the biggest moves, because it was before Stonewall riots, that helped to relieve people from oppression. Whether a person claims to be religious or not, down deep they are, because everybody's had it instilled somewhere along the line. And I think a lot of what society considers norms comes from religious backgrounds. And that, again, the Stonewall riots were an extremely important factor of educating people, such as gay prides across the United States. That's why I asked you, you know, what is Buffalo doing as far as gay pride? Mm-hmm. And I feel that, I guess one of the best things, best way I can explain it is, I think I told you this is my official coming out in Buffalo, whether I would have been ready for this 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that I found out that coming out isn't all that difficult. Mm-hmm. People don't react to you like you think they're going to react, and that has to do with the progress that has been made. And a lot of it has to do with how homosexuality is viewed on television programs and mm-hmm. news media. Of course, we have the, you know, the bombs also. But there's a lot of positive things being done.
Bob, I don't know anything about the Metropolitan Community Church, so could you talk a little bit about why you see it as very important in changing the treatment of gays and the things it's done? Because we don't have such a church here.
I probably can tell the best of my own personal life.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that I probably never really felt like a whole person until I got involved in Metropolitan Community Church.
Mm-hmm.
And that was almost 8 years ago. Prior to that, I was suicidal. I'd been hospitalized in neuropsychiatric wards, a drinking alcoholic, and my life really didn't have any purpose. Mm-hmm. And I found MCC myself personally at a time in my life when I had broken up with a lover. It was a non-gay black man that worked in the building I lived that told me about it. And I think it's back again to religion being such an important factor, and I could see that in Buffalo with the big Catholic population, that you know it's okay to be gay. You know, God's not going to come down and put a lot of wrath on you because you're gay, you know, that you're a lesbian. And I think this is really, really important, whether people admit it or not. I found out that, you know, I can be gay, and it's okay, and I'm not going to burn and go to hell, as so many people think. And everybody needs something. Like I say, I was alone at the time that I found MCC. and it gave me something to live for and to look forward to.
Is it a national organization?
It's international.
Oh.
All over the United States and foreign countries. About a month ago, a group opened up in Copenhagen, Denmark. There are several churches in Australia, England, Toronto, Canada. Nigeria. There's one down in Africa. We're all over the world. Like, as we always say, we're everywhere. It is really, like, last summer in Los Angeles, we had our biannual general conference. And at the final Sunday morning service, there were 3,000 people that attended that service. Ed Ashner from TV was one of the guest speakers. There were politicians from the city of Los Angeles through the whole week, because it runs a week long. And this there tells you that we're not so bad after all. And Metropolitan Community Church is respected. But then, you know, if you mention this to some people, that's why I tend not to talk about it. I was excited about it here and want to talk to those that listen. Because they hear religion, and everybody that's gay usually associates religion with a door being closed in their face.
Right.
And I found, and one of the things I want to clarify that really disturbs me, people call Metropolitan Community Church the gay church.
Uh-huh.
We are not a gay church. We have an outreach to all people. In Tucson, we're comparatively small, but we have a Sunday school. And people look at me kind of weird when I say that. And I tell them they have to hear about Christ and the love of God and these things too. We presently have two non-gay people who attend our services because we're a small group. But your larger churches, you'll find a lot of people who are not gay that attend.
The members of the church, do they come from all kinds of religious backgrounds?
Yeah. We're an interfaith church, ecumenical. One of the highlights of our service is Holy Communion. Every Sunday morning we have Holy Communion. We finish our service up with that. And some of the ministers are against us, but I have done it. We practice transubstantiation, which means the elements become the body and the blood of Christ instead of representing, which is consubstantiation. And this is to make all people comfortable. Now, in our particular service, the people have learned to like gospel music. We start out with a singspiration. And the hymns are more likely to be gospel songs. And then they can go to the more conservative type, to the needs. Now, in Tucson, we have two services. And one of the reasons for that is so that our service will be completely different. Our evening service is very informal. I hate clerics to begin with, and I will not even wear a clerical shirt on Sunday night. But our Sunday morning service, I robe up with the cassock and the stole and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Because we feel that there's needs to be met.
And how do you see this kind of church movement as affecting that gays are less oppressed now? Is it because people feel better about themselves or what?
That's basically it. One of the things that MCC has a task force for social action. We try to get people, we can't stand up there and preach politics. And I always say this, I'm not a political person, but basically I guess I am, because if there's anything that need be that we need to promote to take a stand in, we do it. I think the best example that I can give is when Anita Bryant came to Tucson. And we had a human rights rally, is what it was called. A lot of my people said, well, I can't be seen, I'm closeted, etc. And we had a couple women that were in the Air Force, and that's understandable. But I got so hepped up and so worked up about it that I would say that 3/4 of the people at church attended because it was a real reason to attend. And that was an experience for me of being oppressed again. At that time, we had Gay Coalition, which was a political organization, and they asked me to come out in full robes and to carry a poster that said gay and Christian. Well, like I said, I'm not one who's for showy, but for the cause and for the purpose, I did it, knowing right well that I would be a target. And we had a candlelight vigil before the entire rally, and I was a target. We had over 100 fundamentalists that they got... they were brainwashing you so that they'd say you don't have Jesus in your heart, God doesn't love you, and of course they keep coming up and screaming that to me and screaming it to me. And this one man came up, coming up, one of the scriptures that you use a lot kept coming up and saying, read Romans 8:26-28. And finally I just said to him, it was 8:26. And then I said to him, read 8:28, which means that all good things will come to those who love God. And he finally left me alone. But I found myself starting to scream in these people's faces, too. And when I did that, I just had to stop. It was really horrible. I can't think of his name now, but you'd know him. He is Jim. Very instrumental, an older man, in writing on the gay history.
Jonathan Katz?
No, he's from Los Angeles. Oh, he's written in all the magazines and so forth. He was there, and he remembered me from L.A., and he told me that he had never seen gay people take such abuse in their life. We had absolutely no incidents, you know, violence or anything. Mm-hmm. We had training before, and it was only about maybe 30 people that trained, and there was over 1,000 people there. But it became infectious, you know, when to sit down and so forth. These people were up.
That's amazing. You know,
people were up in the lampposts with speakers, and they stood behind and tried to prevent it. One of the humorous things that I remember is that there's this one guy who was ahead of it. You know, they always have a little leader like we do. And a policeman was standing there, and he kept saying to the policeman, "Let me tell you about Jesus." And the cop kept telling him to move on. And he kept saying, "Let me tell you about Jesus." And the cop told him to move on. Finally, the cop says, "Let me tell you about jail if you don't move on." The police were very supportive. And we had absolutely no violence, no incidents, which could really have been bedlam.
You said that... Oh, wait, I'm going to stop. Okay. You said that the Metropolitan Community Church was started before the Stonewall...
Yes.
Mission. When did it start? And did it have gay members then?
Yes. It started in October of 1968, a year before Stonewall.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And it started in Troy's living room with 12 people in attendance. I have a copy of a record which tells a little bit of the history of the church, which I'll tape for you and send it to you, because the record is now a collector's item. I don't know if you're aware of the book that he has written, which is also a collector's item, but you can get it in the library. It's called The Lord Is My Shepherd, He Knows I'm Gay, written by
Troy Byrne. I've heard about it. Uh-huh.
And it tells how he started it and the various stages they went through.
So essentially you're seeing it before the 68, 69, there were no support services. Everybody had to deal with their own feelings by themselves, and that's real oppression. And now that people can come together and be accepted by religion, that is quite a bit different.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was in California, and I think it's back to what I was saying earlier about that it disturbs me because a lot of the bar people aren't aware that there are other alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware that there were other alternatives, and I'm sure there were in a city like Los Angeles because it's been the most progressive. You know, I was into doing my own thing in my own world. But it is known that Metropolitan Community Church is one of the fastest, in fact, if not the fastest growing churches in the United States and in the world, or the Protestant denominations, if you want to, you know, so put it in that. It's, you know, it's just unbelievable. I forget how many we have, because every time you say how many churches there are, there's more added. There's over 130. Mm-hmm. I know that I've heard since General Conference about a month ago, I heard 21 new groups had started since then. And it disturbs me that Buffalo doesn't have an MCC.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
basically the reason it disturbs me is because I know what it's done for my life.
Right.
And how it's mm-hmm. changed my life around.
Okay, so can you think, okay, that's one thing that you think is really important to include in a history of the lesbian community. Can you think of any other things that you want to make sure were in there, thinking back on your own experiences in life?
The thing that just keeps cropping up in my head, that there's more to life than the bars.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's much more to life. And if, you know, I'm a firm believer, if there isn't something that suits your needs, you can always start it. I have to tell you this, you know, like any organization, a lot of people get very involved in MCC, they become ministers, and they leave because they're unhappy. I'm a firm believer the thing, you can't get things changed by leaving. There are
mm-hmm.
times that I get fed up, that it's not easy. Because I'm really a scapegoat for some of the people in the gay community. But you can't change things by leaving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you have to get involved, and you have to stick in there fighting.
Mm-hmm. And so you'd be saying that, well, do you think when you first came out there were alternatives to the bars, or does that then...
In Buffalo? No.
Yeah.
Nothing.
No.
Nothing.
But it's really in the last 10 years that there have been chances for that, and people have to find those chances.
Right.
In coming back to Buffalo, have you been surprised at, well, no, surprised might be one word. Did you get the feeling that some of your friends had grown in the same ways as you had, looking for new alternatives, and others have remained in the bars? Is that the impression you had? Or what was your feeling?
Well, since I've been out, the couple of nights that I've been out, I've probably seen just about everybody I ever knew. So that tells me that the bars are still a big part of their life.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not as big a part of life as in the past. And talking to individuals, they've grown probably because of age. They look at things about, you know, owning your own home and different things like that. the security, the materialism. But basically, I don't think that their lives have changed really all that much. Like one couple whom you met have been together 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think when we were sitting there talking the other night about some of the crazy things we did 20 years ago, and I remember commenting, did we ever think that we would be sitting here talking about what we did 20 years ago? But in my own mind, which I did not say, here we are sitting in a bar talking about them again.
Right.
One couple said they don't come out very often, but they came out for that special occasion. Yeah. I think in listening to the people that I knew previously, the ones that I talked to at length, their lives revolve a great deal around their families, mm-hmm. mothers and their fathers and, you know, nieces, nephew. And I think that, again, has to do with age. You know, we get a little older and we cling because we realize that they're not going to be here that much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, they're still kind of living the same lifestyle, maybe a little bit more mellow, a little bit more sedate. In fact, I had a saying, and whenever I go back to Buffalo, I see the same old butts on the same old bar stools, but I've added, maybe they're in different bars now because the bars close and others open.
Uh-huh.
But I know that every time I come back, if I go want to see the people I knew, all I have to do is go to a bar.
And
it's kind of sad.
Them, huh?
You know, it's kind of sad.
Huh.
I mean, you know, I know there's some that aren't there. Some that I hear about have passed away. And one of the things that was interesting, I don't know if you heard this before, but I recollect this, how everybody during my era, so to speak, had nicknames tacked on their nicknames.
Huh.
There was Dirty Bobby. There was Hamburg Bobby. There was Rotten Ara. And all these various names, Trenchcoat Betty. I was probably one of the only people that didn't because my nickname was unique to begin with.
Bob. Yeah. Huh. I'll get back to it later. Okay, so we have what you think are the important things. The next thing I wanted to ask you is, you've talked a little bit about it, but maybe we could hear some, you might want to add some to it, is what do you see as the turning points in the lesbian community since you've been out?
Well, I think women coming forth won't take the crap anymore that they used to have to take.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that we can be our own person.
When did you see this occurring?
Well, my awareness again came through MCC because we're very oriented toward inclusiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And it was somewhere along the line. Probably my biggest education was when I was in training as a minister.
Mm-hmm.
There's a humorous story. It's gone all over the country. They call it Buff's Divine Duo. I had we called her Exhorter Coordinator, who was training us, and I was up doing communion. This is while I was in training, and I got up, and I went in the name of the Father and stopped dead, and under my breath said, oh, shit, I'm going to get it when I get down from here, because I should have said Creator instead of Father.
Mm.
It became a stumbling block to me at that point. And now I've had problems in Tucson. There's a split-off group because I use inclusive language. And some of the men have found it very difficult that I want to be accepted as a whole person. And one of the best examples I've tried to give them, but it gives you an example, when people don't want to hear and don't want to become educated how they close an ear, I always tell them, how would you like it if I got up and I preached a sermon and every place where it said man, that I changed it to woman? And every place that it says he, that I changed it to she, and that's all you had to listen to. What would your reaction be? This split-off group that started said that they put in their bylaws that if they ever went back to the terminology of, if they ever used the terminology humankind, they would disband. I mean, pardon me, mankind, they would disband. And the person that said this to me, I said, what is wrong with using humanity or humankind and including me? However, because the person that I've become, this split-off group, and I work very close together now,
huh.
I just let them do their thing and I didn't condemn them. Although we had some little jokes about it. It was called it the Church of the Eternal Fathers. And one of the things that I have learned, and it gets me thinking, is that with all the inclusiveness, we still don't reach the real feminist.
Hmm.
We don't reach the real feminist. Because I think in terms sometimes, I guess I have to say the radical feminist,
mm-hmm.
that they have their mind so close to being...
To being religious, is that?
Well, no, into, you know, down with men, damn the men.
I see, and that it's an inclusive church,
yeah,
I
right.
see, with men and women.
I find that men, the men in my church, I should say our church, that their consciousness is raised more than some of the women.
When did you leave Buffalo?
First time I left to go to California was in 1962.
And then did you come back here?
Yeah, I came back. I was back probably maybe about a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
Then I came back for another short time for about 3 weeks.
And then you were introduced to the church while you were in Los Angeles.
Right.
And what year was that?
1972, I believe.
So in your mind, when you think about turning points in the history, let's say the Buffalo community, you see it as it really was pretty much the same until you left it. You didn't see too much change in it, and that you didn't see the change come about until after you were away from Buffalo. And,
right.
And I see. Right. Okay. Now, why don't we talk about turning points in your own life? What, as you look back on your life, what are the important turning points for yourself? I mean, you've told me one of them. That's when you were introduced to the church, but I was thinking of earlier.
I don't think there was really that many until I was introduced into the church. I was thinking before I came here about the first time I was ever arrested. It was in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And how it all came about. And how terribly frightened I was. Talk about oppression. I was a licensed practical nurse. And I thought being arrested and possibly that they knew that I was gay immediately, that meant I would lose my license. Mm-hmm. And that I wouldn't be able to work in it anymore. That didn't happen, but that fear was there. It was really...
What year was that?
It was during the years that the Midtown was open. So I can't... I think that was about 61 or 62.
Uh-huh.
Somewhere along there.
So you'd see that as an important point that gave you something to think about in your life.
Yeah, particularly, you know, my livelihood was going to be taken away from me. But as far as before, coming from Buffalo, but before that, I've always said, well, I've never really felt oppressed. But as I think back, yes, I did. I was in the military for almost 6 years.
Hmm.
And the second time that I got out, I turned myself in for being gay. Because I had the fear of, I guess you would say, being caught. That goes back to when I was first in the military. I was stationed in Seattle, Washington, and I was called in on an investigation. And I was very new into gay life, and probably very green as a woman, you know, at the age of 19, 20. And it got thrown out, which is a long and tailed thing. When I did turn myself in, I made sure that I said I only had homosexual tendencies, because then I knew I would get a general undesirable conditions. But that was my main reason for getting out. Living in the fear of being caught and getting a dishonorable discharge.
Uh-huh. When did you come to realize that you were gay?
Well, I wasn't in service too long. As I told you one night we were speaking, that I found myself attracted to the gay people when I was in basic training, the lesbians, but not aware of why. And then everybody started telling me, no, you don't want to hang around with us, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, well, you know, you do your own thing. I like you. You're my friends. And then after that, I went to a surgical tech school in Texas, and that's where I came out.
Huh. What year was that you joined the Army?
1950. That's right. February 1st, 1950. I was 19 years old.
Oh, my goodness. So, and then you were in the Army, let's say, about 6 months, or not even that much, when you became aware of these feelings.
Right. Mm-hmm. Probably about 5 months.
5 months. And you had never had them before?
I wasn't aware of what they were. I believe that I had them because I remember I used to tell a story. You know, everybody used to read those true story magazines and so forth back in those days. And I said, yeah, I could never understand why I didn't get turned on like everybody else did, and that it was very easy for me to say no to a man. So apparently the feelings were there, but I wasn't able to identify them.
Did you have any early crushes that you think about on women or anything like
yeah.
that?
Mm-hmm.
You did.
Yeah.
But you kind of
wasn't able to identify what they were. I can remember specifically when I was about 16 years old, I was... water safety instructor and camp counselor at Westminster Camp out here in Angola.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a particular woman counselor who had feelings, but not able to identify what they were. In fact, I've told many people, I think back into the day of when I first came out as a lesbian, that we didn't even use the word lesbian, we didn't use the word gay. If we saw somebody who was gay, we'd always say, look at the fairies.
Oh, is that right? That was in the 50s, early
50s. Yeah, that
50s.
Was part of the dialogue in those days, the fairies, whether it was a man or a woman.
Huh.
Because I remember back to the carousel days, a lot of non-gay people would come in there, you know, to see the gay people. And we used to always, you know, get a little drunk and carry out and say, well, they're here to see the fairies if they stick around and see the fairies fly at midnight.
Yeah. Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, when I think about the carousel, I remember the experiences that I went through when you'd see somebody walk through the front door that you had grown up with, that you went to school with, or they lived in your neighborhood. Should you run out the back door, or what should you do? You know, usually everybody ran to the ladies' room or they're out the back door. And I came to grips with that by saying, well, if they're not gay, of course we didn't use the word gay then. I don't remember what we used. Other than the fact that the only thing I think, if they're not like me,
stop and think just, a minute. Can you think at all what you
I
use?
I would say probably queer, because
queer.
That word was used. How can they point a finger in here at me being in here if they're in here?
Right,
and that's how
right.
was my rationale, so that I stopped running. And many times, any of the people that I ran into that I knew as I grew up, the reaction wasn't adverse. It wasn't shock or anything like that. And once you got, I guess it's sort of like coming out. In a way, you're coming out to the people that came in there. We didn't even know about coming out. We didn't know about closets in those days. That you felt more comfortable. You know, one more person knew you and accepted you.
What do you mean you didn't know about coming out and you didn't know about closets?
I never heard the terms.
You never heard the terms?
No. You didn't go around telling people that you preferred women instead of men. Because you were afraid of the oppression, how you'd become ostracized.
So you would just kind of know it in yourself and know that you were queer.
Mm-hmm.
And then that meant you would go to the bars.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't talk about coming out or whatever.
No, no you didn't. You know, I don't know of anybody that said to their family, well, I have something I want to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
However, any relationships that I've been in with women, one woman that I was here in Buffalo with, which a lot of people knew, Gordy, in fact, people still ask me about her when I come back. We were together for a very long time, almost 13 years. In fact, we met in the service and got out together. My family accepted her, but I never know whether they accepted her as a lover or what. And it's always been that way with my family. I have an aunt and uncle that are still alive here, and Jean, my present mate, who I've been with almost 6 years, they accept her as a member of the family. They have always treated the person that I was with like they've treated me. And I haven't been with that many that they know or they've met. But I've been very fortunate that. So there was really no need to say, this is my lover, I want you to accept my lover too.
Well, going back, if you joined the service in 1950, and so really you came to recognition, that came out, you came to recognition yourself in the service, and that was through the support of other women in the service.
Well, I can tell you exactly how it happened.
Okay.
I guess we can all remember that.
Okay.
I was also very adverse to drinking in those days.
Uh-huh.
And of course everybody drank.
Right.
And I remember there was a woman that was in the Air Force, Fort Sam Houston, and she used to tell me, you know, shouldn't hang around with us. In fact, she was up for being discharged. We were coming back from Beaton Town on a Sunday night, and she told me that she was a very impulsive person and that she always did what her impulses told her to do, and then she leaned over and kissed me and said that was like I had that impulse. And my only reaction to it was that was really neat, I like it.
Uh-huh.
And I accepted it right there. I didn't go, you know, wow or shock or anything like that. I liked it. And that was the beginning.
Huh. Did you see her more after that, or it was just...
Yeah. Because she was getting out, you know, she was very overt about her feelings, and that kind of bothered me. In fact, I was called in by one of the sergeants that were in charge and told me that I shouldn't be hanging around with the people that I was hanging around with because that I know that I was going to get in trouble. But even at that point, I was still very naive.
And did you get into a sexual relation with this same woman?
No.
No, just kind of affection and...
No. The only thing I knew about, took me a long time to come out as far as the... overt sexually about was necking and petting and didn't know anything else. In fact, I tell you a humorous story. It's very embarrassing, but it's very funny. This one woman was after my body, so to speak. So we went downtown and we got a hotel.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I must have been pretty good at necking and petting, but I didn't know what you did beyond that. And she kept pushing my head, and I don't know what the hell she was pushing my head for. And she got up and got her clothes on and got mad and left.
Uh-huh.
So finally one day there was ironically from California, a woman, her name was Joan. We were in the shower, and I told her what happened and asked her, what do you do? And so she explained it all to me. So after that...
And this was how much later from
Well, I was still in school in Fort Sam Houston. So I went through 13 weeks of basic training, and I was there 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm. So it was within 8 weeks.
Yeah.
So that you got. So Joan explained it all, and then after that you
felt... The many various positions, but I found out since I grew older, she didn't know them all. I've learned a few since.
And she was in the Army.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, were you in the Army or the Air Force?
Army. But see, there were Army and Air Force going to school there.
I see. And so she was in the Army. And she had been gay for a while?
Yeah, she was gay when she had come into the service. I guess at that point, I don't know if it was that I didn't know any better. I guess you couldn't say I was bisexual, but I was dating a guy who was there, and yet I was attracted to women. I still hadn't fully gone over the...
Uh-huh. And how long did it take you, and what happened that made you realize that you were a lesbian or queer or whatever?
Only that I was attracted to lesbians, to gay people. And I wasn't aware that they were gay. It was just something that I felt comfortable.
And how long, let's say, after Joan gave you the word, then how long did it take you before you finally had a sexual relationship with somebody?
You know, I really can't remember. I think it wasn't until I went on to Seattle, Washington.
Uh-huh.
You know, going back, I'm recollecting now that I can remember when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
During World War II, I wanted a bicycle. And I didn't want a girl's bicycle, as they called it in that day. I wanted a boy's bicycle and use that excuse that, I don't know why, but the excuse that you couldn't get girls' bikes. Bikes were very hard to get, so I had a boy's bike. And I'm going back before I went in the service. My mother's saying, if you buy another pair of blue jeans, I'm going to burn them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as you can see now, I've always loved ski sweaters. I've been queer for ski sweaters for years. And I used to wait for my brother to go to school and I'd sneak in and wear his sweaters. And I don't know if you remember or heard of when we used to wear the long white shirts and the rolled up blue jeans and the saddle Oxfords. I used to go in and sneak my brother's shirts, and my brother used to say to my mother, I can stand anything. And my family calls me Sissy. But when Sis wears my clothes, that's too much. I was attracted to them because they were comfortable.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was always, I guess you would call the nonconformist. All my life, I was always doing things different. Not that that has anything to do with being gay, but I was more comfortable in that type of clothing.
So you didn't feel at all wanting to wear his clothes was wanting to be a boy at all. It was more, don't you know?
I don't know. But to me, it tells me something. It tells me something. You know, as I thought back on it, there was probably some subconscious reason.
So let's see. So we're back in 1950-51 in the service. Was there like a community of lesbians or queers or whatever?
Yeah. Just like nowadays. You know, you had your gay community, but it wasn't called gay community. The lesbians banded together and were friends, which was very natural because they... had very much in common.
Right.
And I remember in Seattle going to a gay bar to a female impersonator show. It was probably my first one. And his name just came to me. Ricky Reynolds from Buffalo, New York, was a female impersonator. And after going to the service, you know, coming back to Buffalo, I ran into him in the gay bars. And I remember telling him I saw him in Seattle, Washington.
Well, would that be 1952?
Probably 51.
Still 51. Mm-hmm. And so... When you moved from Texas to Washington, it wasn't a big disruption. You made new gay friends there or lesbian?
Yeah, I remember saying at the time when I started with basic, I didn't like goodbyes. But in the military service is so small. When you went from post to post, there was always somebody you knew before. Very, very small city. I guess the best way to explain to you, you know, you're asking about the gay community in the military. I one time sat down and I said, you know, a military post is just like any city. That they have their movie theater, they have their store, they have all kinds of people. In fact, this isn't to do with that time, but I happen to think of this, so I should tell you what I think about it. I remember going to a doctor with a friend of mine back in Venice, California, and she was an alcoholic, and she went to this doctor who a lot of people went to just to get pills and so forth, who has been put out of business. And she was in the Navy, and he was a big mouth guy, you know, very crude, and I remember him saying, Miss Byersdorfer, I heard you were in the Navy, and I heard that 50%, probably said girls in the Navy were butch. And I remember saying to him, you know, Dr. Goldstein, that's very right. I said, but you've been really misinformed. Most people think that the women in the service were prostitutes. Well, 50% were butch, and the other 50% were femme. And I added, we were all queer.
So you, you say that there were a lot of gay women in Seattle.
And I've met many, many gay women. That's where they came out, was in the service. Every place you went, there were gay women.
And why do you think that is? Is that because there was a community that helped people come to terms with their feelings?
Well, I don't know, other than the fact that, you know, you asked me previously about, was I aware with my gay feelings earlier? And I think the reason I wasn't, because I wasn't around any gay people and didn't have a chance to have them brought up. I think it's being around gay people. You feel, you know, you're put in a situation where you're comfortable to come out. Because there are other people like you, you're not the only one.
Right, right. When you came, well, no, we got, I shouldn't use the word came out, because that's not what you all use then. When you realized that you were queer, did you know right away that you were butch, or did that take you some time to figure that out?
I don't know. I haven't always been comfortable with that term. I've been me. I've been me. One of the things that Jean had said since we've been here, she said, you know, people are still very much into roles in Buffalo. And I said, well, thinking back, I can remember one of the things I used to say. People would say, are you butch or are you femme? And I used to say, well, the only difference to me between a butch or a femme is when you get up on the dance floor so you don't have to argue who's going to lead. And I have another saying that I've since then. My biggest decision when I get up every morning is whether I'm going to be an aggressive femme or a Nelly Butch.
That's cute. Well, so was that possible back in the 50s in the service? Did people think you were weird that you didn't identify strongly one way or the other? Or did you just, for the surface, identify as butch and then had your feelings?
I think on the surface identified. I can remember a woman asking me one time whether I was butch or femme. And I didn't answer because I didn't feel I could answer. But going back to Buffalo and years ago when I was involved in the gay community, on the surface, you know, you either had to be butch or femme. And I always was the, I guess you'd say, butch appearing one. Back to the days when DA haircuts were popular. In fact, one of my sayings is that I can remember when I used to use Brill Cream and now I use hairspray.
So then essentially you're saying that in the Army it wasn't as important which role you were as it was when you were in the, came back to Buffalo in the bars.
Again, it might have been Liz, but I wasn't aware of it.
Like I say,
I've always been a nonconformist. I've been, when you get right down to it, I've been considered a nonconformist because I've been my own person. I've always done whatever is comfortable with me.
So how long were you in Seattle in the Army?
I'm trying to think. I think till 51, because then I went to Europe. I was stationed in Germany.
With the Army?
Yeah. It was really crazy. In fact, it's funny how these things come up. I had really had it made in Seattle because my commanding officer was gay. And she knew some people that I knew in Buffalo, and I became very good friends with her. And I was extremely good friends with the director of the service club on the post. And I used to travel with them. And as I look back, now I know that they became lovers. We never talked about being gay or being different or liking women. We had a 12 o'clock bed check. And all Joe David, who was the in charge of the service club, would call up. I can't remember the commanding officer's name and tell him that I had to work at the service club, or call the officer, whoever was on duty at the time, and I was allowed to stay out later. And sometimes I'd go out with the three of them. You know, three of us go out together. And it really had me, you know, had a good position.
So, but you were only there a short time, and then you went to
Germany. I'm trying to think. I was there probably from July of 50 to December of 51. Well, I arrived in Bremerhaven, in Germany on December 7th. 51.
And then how long were you in Germany?
Well, I came back. I was discharged, my first discharge, on February 14th, 1953. So I was over there until then.
That's a pretty long time.
I didn't drink until I went to Germany.
Is that right? Yeah. You didn't drink at all? Yeah. What was it about Germany that got it started?
Probably because everybody else did. There was nothing to do. And the German beer was a lot different. And, we used to go, they call them the guest houses. You call them tavern here. And spent a lot of time.
You must have been unusual in the service in Washington if you didn't drink, or is that not the case? You were.
Yeah, I can remember back at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, they had a beer garden outside, and I used to sit and eat ice cream while people drank. I've been a swimmer all my life. I've taught swimming here in Buffalo, and I spent a lot of time at the swimming pool. I was very much, I love the water. You know, I learned how to swim here in Lake Erie.
Was there a community of lesbians or queers or whatever in Germany as well?
Oh, yes. Yes,
the same, yes, huh? Yes. Was that 50% butch and 50% femme, or...?
Well, I don't really know. That's all true. Yeah, in fact, one of my best friends was in the Air Force, who went over on the ship with me, and she was gay. In fact, right in the middle of the, you know, Atlantic Ocean, I chummed around with gay people going over.
Huh, that's amazing. Yeah. Did you, have you had, by the time you get to Germany, have you had a first relationship already?
Yeah.
You have. Did you go with your lover to Germany, or wasn't
no,
it that
no.
serious?
Any relationships that I ended up in while I was in the service were just kind of fast. They weren't long-term
they
relationships.
They weren't. Even
except the last one that I told you about, that I got out with.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
She probably was the only one.
And even in Germany, that was the case. Huh?
Yeah. I always had crushes on somebody.
Uh-huh. Well, did you think it was a hard life there, or was it kind of a fun, footloose life?
Well, not as far as the military went. I remember it was during peacetime. It was right after the Korean War.
Right.
And as we used to call it, it was very chicken shit. Very chicken. The military itself. But other than that, as far as the people, probably no different than today. We still had a good time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what would people do? Kind of, was there, were there gay bars in Germany?
Not in Heidelberg. I don't think there was one place that I went to, like one gay bar. Of course, you were very careful. You
mm-hmm.
had to be very, very careful. The German people are fun-loving people. They had a good time. Remember, I was never very good in softball or basketball, but I joined the team so I could travel. Travel. And the first time I ever really got in trouble was in Germany. We went to the finals in ball tournament, and we lost the very first game. So that meant party time. And in the WAC detachment, they had a room, sort of like a recreation room, and they had a big party. And there was this one woman that I had a crush on. And this other woman was making passes at her. I remember taking my drink. It was the first time that I really showed anger. I broke the glass against the radiator, and I cut my hand. Well, it ended up later that somebody got into a fight, which I wasn't in it. But a whole bunch of us got what we called delinquency reports. We were written up by MPs. And we got back to our WAC detachment in Heidelberg, and the officer that we had was really rough, really hard. And they had what they called Article 15, which was competent punishment. And everybody was going to get Article 15. And I was a corporal at the time. And they had recently changed it that unless you had three strikes, that you could lose one stripe under company punishment. I think that's probably the first time I ever stood up for myself. I went into the commanding officer's office, and she said, you will lose one stripe. You will sign company punishment. I said, no, I will not. And she kept telling me, you will. That's a term used in the military. You will. And I said, I will not. I will take trial by court-martial. And I remember the various women in the WAC detachment told me I was crazy, that it would be on my record that if I took a court-martial. I said, well, don't you think one stripe is not going to be on my record? Promotions were hard to come by then because it was during mm-hmm. peacetime. I said, I had to wait over a year to get this, and I'm not losing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the charges was I was supposed to beat this 6-foot woman up, and I'm 5'2". And the court martial I went to, you went before one officer. And I remember the day we were there, he called her in first, called me and asked my side, and he called us both in, and he looked at me and her side by side and just laughed. So I got a $20 fine paid, or $5 a month. And we had to do that just because we were getting up. But I thought, if I was signed that company person, I would have lost a promotion, and I would have lost X amount of dollars per month.
Huh. So if people didn't go out together to boys, the queer women, if they didn't do that, how did you see one another? Kind of playing cards together, or playing sports together?
Sports,
or?
Yeah, you know, all the lesbians were attracted to the sports. But it was there was a group of us who were friends, and we traveled together,
mm-hmm.
went out together
mm-hmm.
and stuff.
And then whatever you did was kind of on the sly or whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Let's see. In your friend in the service, were they both butch and femme in your circle of friends?
Yeah, right.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And like I say, I think there never was one that really discussed that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did the
Your friends, did they discuss being lesbians together or queer together? Or you all just knew it and kept quiet about it?
It's something that you didn't even talk much about among yourselves. You accepted one another as the way you were.
And if you needed to ask somebody a question, you did it quietly on the side and heard you. Okay, so you came back in 53. You came back to Buffalo?
Yeah, I got out of the service for a while.
And then
I joined what's called the active reserves. And then after I was out, less than a year, I went back on what they called active duty. I was recalling my first, I guess you'd say, finding a gay bar in Buffalo. I can still see it.
And this would be in 53?
53.
Dugan's,
North Division, South Division, Ellicott.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I found out that was possibly a gay bar. And I remember walking by it. Of course, and with the skirt on, and even more slacks, at least I had more slacks on. And I didn't have enough nerve to go in. And I walked back and forth a couple of times, and this woman came out and said, are you looking for, I don't remember the time she said, if it was gay or not. And I said, yeah, so she said, come in. And Dugan's was a mixed bar, non-gay and gay, which was a very prevalent thing in Buffalo at that time, with the exception of the Carousel. I don't know if you ever heard of that, but.
People in it was an all day one.
Right. So she showed me that, and after that the ice was kind of broken. And I remember Pat's, which was gone at that time. The first time I ever went in there, there was a fight. Glasses were flying and everything. I was not ever subjected to anything like that. I remember I went under a table. Oh my God, what is this? But I kept going back because this is the only way that I could get to know people that were like myself.
How did you support yourself in 53?
I can't remember what I did at that time. Because I remember. I went to work at Westinghouse.